for tuning into the Psychology Is podcast. I'm Nick, and I'm here with Dr. Tanya Israel, who's a professor of counseling psychology at UC Santa Barbara and author of a book that I think the more people that read it, the better off we'll be, called Beyond Your Bubble: How to Connect Across the Political Divide. How are you today, Tanya?
I'm doing just fine. How about yourself? And I am delighted to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. I'm doing just fine too. I'm recording this at a time when my wife and I just had a new baby about 5 weeks ago.
Oh, congratulations. That's so exciting.
Thank you. Yes. And yeah, it's just such a primal state of raising a child. Those first few weeks, eat, take care, protect, clean, sleep. I operate like that. And anyway, I wasn't planning to share any of this at the beginning of this podcast, but you drew it out of me somehow. It's been really...
You're having a very human experience. So thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome. Yes. I'm excited for this conversation. I feel like it's such a relevant topic, of course. As you say, you know, in the beginning of your book, the United States is acutely divided. And then you also say we are in turmoil. Political divisiveness is at an all-time high. And I think you really get the way that this is hitting closer and closer to home. I mean, it is hitting home, I think, for more and more people, maybe we should say. Just in terms of personal relationships being affected by differing political views. Mm-hmm. So can you just talk to me about, like, in your words, what is your assessment of the current state of affairs related to political divisiveness?
Sure. I think there are several different dimensions to what's going on right now. One is that people are really distressed and really kind of suffering this divisiveness. So I hear from people who are having conflict in their families, in their relationships, in their communities, certainly in their social media circles. And it is so distressing for folks. And people are also really pessimistic about the idea that we can move beyond it. So I think that both there's conflict and there's a sense of hopelessness. There's this other piece that I have seen going on, which is that our assessment of the situation is actually somewhat distorted. So people are feeling like, you know, this political divide is there either people who are over here or over here, and there's, you know, and they're so far apart, and that polarization is so great. And the truth is, we are more polarized than we have been in recent history. And at the same time, there's this piece that we're missing, which is that there are all these people in between those two sides. And those are the folks we don't hear from as much. And so they're also giving me hope that people can have conversations with people who are not in their bubble, not necessarily people who are all the way on the other side, but that there are so many more possibilities. And if we are thinking that everyone is only the polar opposite of who we are, we're going to avoid those conversations altogether. So the first thing that I think is important is that people sort of recognize the landscape of who these other human beings are and the potential we have to connect with them.
Mm. Yeah, I sometimes feel almost left out when I hear descriptions of different political views, because I do find myself to be somewhere between those extremes, as most of us do, because like you said, although there is truth to increased divisiveness and polarity, that is also exaggerated. And the degree to which we think that's true is perhaps distorted. So what do you think causes this distorted perception?
Well, it turns out that human beings have some tendencies to not see things accurately. And one of the things we don't see accurately is people who disagree with us. And we tend to see people who don't agree with us as being more extreme, as being misinformed, and even, you know, immoral or unkind. So we really question lots of levels of those people who are different from us that we may not be accurate in our assessments. In fact, we're probably not. And it's just psychology is. This is just the way we are as human beings.
Do you think that tendency is kind of capitalized upon by anybody who has, you know, media companies and anyone who has an incentive to kind of draw attention, and anyone who has an incentive to exaggerate that tendency or, again, capitalize on it?
Well, I think I'm not going to try to figure out what, you know, people's motivations are who have control over these communication sources. I just know that I always focus on, like, what can we do and what are we doing, like, the most people, you know, because people always say, well, what about the elected officials and what about the media? And I'm like, okay, well, most of us aren't elected officials. Most of us aren't the media, but we're all kind of creating this situation. So one of the best things that we can do is just kind of take back our power by recognizing those distortions that we ourselves are making and correct for them. And we can do that. We can do that, first of all, by recognizing that we have some distorted perceptions. The other thing that we can do, honestly, is to actually have contact with people who have views that are different from our own. And I mean, I'm a researcher, so I'm like, just gather the data yourself, you know, actually have a conversation where you're really listening to someone, you're really trying to understand, and that might help to correct for some of those distorted perceptions. It might help you to see that that person is either not as far apart or not completely illogical, not completely misinformed, not being unkind in terms of their motivations. And that, I think, might help us to heal that.
I appreciate that answer. I felt it I see it in myself that it's easier to blame media companies for depicting people in these extreme, you know, inaccurate ways, essentially, or to just focus in on extreme expressions of political ideologies. But it's quite a different feeling, and it's one of much greater empowerment to say, how can I recognize how I am seeing people in my own reality in distorted ways, or depicting them as caricatures of a viewpoint in my own mind, and kind of seeing them through that filter. So I appreciate that answer, that we can take back our own power and responsibility to keep our perceptions in check and make an effort to form relationships and get to know people and understand people who really do think differently about certain issues. Beautiful.
And I want to acknowledge what you were saying about the media. You know, the media does have an influence on us. Some of that is because of what we want to see in the media. And so it's reflecting that in some ways. It turns out it's a more interesting story to talk about people who are violent extremists. People want to tune into that more than they want to tune into interviews with people who say, yeah, I can pretty much see both sides of this issue. You know, that apparently just doesn't make good TV. But it does turn out that the people who are more in the middle of things pay attention to different kinds of media than the people who are on the extremes. They're more, people in the middle are more likely to pay attention to the network news rather than cable news, and on either side. And so and it turns out that the more we pay attention to the news sources that are, you know, more affiliated with the left or right, the more distorted our views of the other side are. And so that's one of the things that we can do. Like, we might think, oh, I'm I'm getting more and more informed because I'm paying more and more attention to, you know, to whatever my news source is. But depending on what you're paying attention to, it might actually be further distorting your understanding, not just of what's going on in the world, but even more so of people who might have a different position than you do. Mm.
And as we all know, some of the most disrespectful debates take place on social media platforms where we really lose our dignity, in a sense, our respect for other people in the way we communicate sometimes. And I say we loosely because I like to think that I don't lose my respect for other people when communicating online, but we all know this is common and people feel freer to say what's really on their mind than they do when they're face to face with somebody. And I often think about how it's kind of the first time where you can have nothing but a debate without any kind of emotional, like without any, yeah, emotional connection, in a sense. Yeah. It's like, it's almost like if emotional connection is the foundation of a relationship, then you can deal with disagreements and stuff as long as that is strong. But we're now having all kinds of interactions where there's none of that emotional connection or empathy, and it's just debates that escalate and get heated. And
It's, you know, social media is really playing into this because, and I think it's creating more of those echo chambers that we talk about, because first of all, the people who are actually speaking out about political things on social media are more extreme. And so it also sort of supports that illusion that we have that everybody is extreme. The other thing that we do is we think, oh, if somebody says something that I disagree with, I'm going to engage with the other side. Like, I'm going to engage in dialogue on social media. Well, it turns out what happens on social media is not what I would define as dialogue. And it's not even debate. It doesn't help somebody to understand your side better to post something that's, you know, in contrast to what they're saying, to make a comment on their Facebook post or to tweet back at them or whatever, that doesn't actually help them to see your side better. It's not going to bring them around. In fact, there's this really interesting study that was done on Twitter where they had people, Republicans and Democrats participate, and people who are Republicans, they were sent liberal tweets, and people who were Democrats were sent conservative tweets. And it turns out that not only did it not bring these sides together, it actually pushed them farther apart, that the more people paid attention to these tweets that were in contrast to their views, the further embedded they got in their own perspectives.
And that, you know, so let's go into you. I love the way you clearly delineate between what a diatribe is, what a debate is, what discourse is, and what dialogue is. I found that to be extremely helpful. There's so many just concrete practical tools that you're offering in this book. And I really do strongly recommend it to anyone listening who's intrigued by this conversation. It's so helpful. And even just these definitions were very helpful to me. So perhaps you can hit on each one. What is a diatribe? What is debate? What is discourse? What is dialogue?
Mm-hmm. So I feel like diatribe is what we hear so much, like on TV, in social media, when somebody is just venting and just expressing their views, and it in some ways doesn't even matter if there's someone there receiving that. That's really diatribe. When we're talking about debate, I mean, debate can be very formal. You know, there's debate clubs and there's rules around debate, but it's very much about people expressing different things in order to try to win. You know, you're trying to win the argument. And some of that's through logic and some of that's through, you know, emotion and whatever it is, but it's that there's an idea that there's a judge who is going to determine like who's got the best answer. And so often people are having conversations with other people as if it's a debate, as if it's there's some judge somewhere who's going to be evaluating you. Now, discourse can often be a little bit more about, trying to develop a shared understanding, but very much about sharing ideas, research, things like that. And so that can be a little bit more engaged together. But dialogue, the way I describe it, is really about developing understanding and connection with another person. And none of those other things are about the connection piece. And I thank you for asking this question, because I feel like it gives me an opportunity to talk about why that connection is so important. Because it turns out that, all of these things, sharing ideas, like I think sharing ideas is great, like that can be really valuable. But if you don't already have a connection, it's not going to get you anywhere in terms of either bringing someone around to your side or any other goals that you might have. I always ask people when I do these workshops, I say, like, what brings you here? What are your motivations? And the things that people tell me most are, there's someone in my life who I have a connection with, but I'm having trouble maintaining that connection. We're having conflict because of our different views. Or sometimes people say, I want to convince or persuade other people, or I want to find common ground. Or a lot of people say, I simply cannot fathom how people can think or act or vote as they do. For any of those goals, it's important to go beyond simply sharing ideas and to actually have a foundation of relationship or connection in order to achieve those goals.
And I see that as how sometimes there's a pre-established relationship in place, like family members, where you haven't really talked a lot about politics, and then you start to, or friends. And then there's also people you just meet, and it's kind of like the conversations around these issues come up prior to there being able to be a relationship formed. But I also understand that you're saying that the dialogue itself can cultivate that connection. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great distinction that you're making. So sometimes there's someone, your cousin or your friend from high school or someone who's been in your life a long time, who you've got a very deep connection and relationship with. But then there's also, the people in your community who you might have had some lighter interactions with, and, there's this difference of view. And sometimes there's like the person next to you on the bus, or wherever you are, and or on the airplane where you're stuck there with them for hours, but you don't have any prior relationship and you can't leave. So what do you do about that? So those different levels of relationship, I think, first of all, help people to decide whether or not they want to put the effort into having this conversation to begin with. So before I wrote the book, the first thing I started with was I created this thing that I call the flowchart that will resolve all political conflict in our country, because I'm optimistic like that. All we need is a flowchart. Spoiler alert, it has not yet resolved all political conflict in our country, but I tend to think that's just a distribution issue, exactly. So just more people need to see it. But the very first question I ask in the flowchart is, do you want to have this conversation? And if you don't want to have a conversation, then you don't have to, you don't need to. And so that's the first thing, because people are always like, oh, do I have to talk to this person or do I really have to engage? And I'm like, no, like you don't have to. And I would say, but think about, like, what are your motivations? What are your goals? And if your goals lead you to want to do that, then here's how to actually go about having that conversation and meeting your goals successfully. So if somebody's got a history with somebody, they might have a greater motivation to hang on to that relationship and then to have a conversation. A lot of people tell me they're avoiding those conversations, and sometimes that's the right answer to maintain the relationship, but that's also creating some tension for people. So I want to help people think about how might you have a conversation that can feel successful, in those relationships. And if it's someone in your community who you have sort of, your kids' friends, parents, or something like that, who you're not as invested in, but they're people who you have these connections with, you can decide, like, maybe this is a good opportunity for, if you're like, I simply can't understand people, well, maybe you have somebody right there in front of you who can help you to understand. Do you really want to understand enough then to invest in that conversation? If it's somebody next to you on the plane, same kind of thing. Like, if you want to understand, this might be an opportunity, but there's obviously also just some risk involved in opening that up.
I see the point that perhaps sometimes when there's a little bit of emotional distance, like someone on the plane next to you, it's almost a good experimental grounds, you know, for just trying out dialogue and probably if you do it respectfully, feeling connected to that person, even if you may never see them again. But I do think, yeah, sometimes people have that anticipatory anxiety that you talk about when the stakes are high, when they know that, like, this is my mom, this is my dad, this is my brother, this is my cousin, I can't lose this relationship, but we strongly disagree on this issue.
Yeah.
That's really uncomfortable.
It is. And I think that that's such an important point in terms of thinking about what are the stakes in this. And I always suggest that people start trying these things out in more low stakes situations. So if you're going to talk to somebody on the plane, maybe start with a short flight. So, you know, you're only going to be with them for, you know, 45 minutes or an hour. If you're flying cross country or internationally, that's a long time to be stuck with somebody if, you know, there's a lot of tension that comes up. But even just start, you know, and we can talk more about the kinds of skills that that I suggest people try to use. But I think trying out those skills in even a non-conflictual situation that's not all about politics, if you're trying to listen, if you're trying to listen reflectively, and we can talk about what that means, maybe try that just when a friend is talking to you about a problem that right. they're having, and you can just test this out and try it where it's not something that you're so nervous about.
Right. Like an athlete lifting weights in the weight room to be stronger on the field type of thing. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. I love it. I do want to talk about these tools. I also just, yeah, I'm just as optimistic about your flow chart. I think it's beautiful. We all love flow charts. And perhaps I thought about maybe, you know, reading each step of it. I think that's worth it, actually. I think people listening would appreciate it. If you don't mind, I will. So it'll take just a couple minutes here, and it's so worth it. So the question, like you said, is, do you want to have a conversation with someone who holds political views different from your own? If no, move along. This chart's not for you. You don't have to.
Can I ask you, would you like me to share my screen? I could
that
actually show
perfect.
The flowchart. Okay.
The only thing I'll say too, though, is that some people only listen to the audio. But
oh, yes.
I actually would, I'll still take you up on that. And I think it would be more powerful to hear you read it off. So would you be so kind? I'll give you screen sharing capabilities so that the people who are watching on YouTube can see it.
Okay, so this is the flow chart that will resolve all political conflict in our country. So the first question is, do you want to have a conversation with someone who holds political views different from your own? And if not, move along. This chart is not for you. And if yes, you do want to have this conversation, do you want to vent, have an argument, or generate conflict? And if so, okay, raise your voice, interrupt, question someone's motives, point out why they're wrong, say, are you kidding me? And if no, you don't want to vent or have an argument or generate conflict, then start by listening, allowing interrupted speaking, reflecting back what you hear, using I statements, and asking open-ended questions. And from there, you know, do you want to understand their perspective? And if you don't, maybe you should rethink having this conversation at all. And if you do want to understand their perspective, then you can try various ways of perspective taking. And that includes being curious and non-judgmental, really focusing on the other person and trying to understand them. Assume they have positive intentions. Ask questions, float hypotheses, try advocating for their position, try really taking on their point of view. and consider why they might hold their views. And then think about what your goal is. If you're trying to find common ground, then seeking shared personal or political hopes, fears, goals, interests, likes, dislikes, experiences, things that you have in common beyond politics. And sometimes you might actually need to agree to disagree, that you're not going to find common ground in the area that you wanted to. And if your goal is to persuade, you want to make sure that you're understanding their perspective and treating them with respect. And if you're not able to do that, then maybe loop back around to perspective taking. And if you do want to try to persuade them, then you want to think about what are their priorities? What are their moral priorities? And so there's some really interesting work on this. Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, lays this all out very, very nicely in terms of liberals and conservatives all having morals, but they have different moral priorities to appeal to. And if you're appealing to your own moral priorities, then you're not getting it. You need to go with what's important to somebody else. And in all of that, you also want to make sure that you're addressing how you're feeling, what's your emotional state. If you've got distressing feelings coming up, you know, you can be aware of those. You can breathe. You can try to remember what your motivations are, pause if you need to, seek support elsewhere, but, you know, noticing what's going on for you internally and managing that at the same time that you're doing all these various behaviors in the conversation.
Yes.
And that's all we need to do.
That's it. It's straightforward. Let's just do it. One thing that jumps out at me, interestingly, is I think when I first saw this, when I saw down at the end of the flowchart where it says, what is your goal after you've kind of taken on the perspective, either common ground or persuade, initially, I admit that I thought common ground was the proper turn to take there. Like, that's always the right thing to do. But I'm also realizing that, of course, there have been many times where the ethics around certain political viewpoints have been pretty objective, you know, like people who are people still who believe that, let's say, gay people shouldn't get married. I think they need to be persuaded. And I mean, this is, of course, I'm expressing my own viewpoint here, admittedly, but I think there have definitely been times in history and still where persuasion is an important goal sometimes for certain dialogue. Would you say that still counts as dialogue if you do feel the need to persuade somebody's views?
Oh, it's often what motivates people for dialogue, right? Is that they want to persuade or convince. The thing that I'm aware of is that if you go into wanting to persuade or convince somebody, you have to start with wanting to understand them, because you will never be successful if you don't want to understand them. And one of the things that I find is if I am curious enough about where someone's coming from to really get onto a deeper level of not just what their opinion is, but, oh, like, how did they develop that opinion? Yeah. And what are their life experiences related to that? By the time I sort of go through that whole process, it actually shifts my goal. And I go, yeah, well, I'm probably not going to, like, it helps me, first of all, do a realistic assessment of, I'm probably not going to persuade them any more than they're going to persuade me. Because I always think that's one of the first perspective taking things that you can do, is like, if you think, oh, I'm going to change somebody's mind about this, especially if you think I'm going to change somebody's mind by just telling them the stuff that I've been reading. And, you know, that's it. Well, if someone else did that with you, what are the chances that they would change your mind? Not very high, right? I probably learned this most powerfully back in the 90s when I started a group to bring together pro-choice and pro-life people to have dialogue with each other. I mean, talk about a really divisive, heated issue, right? And I went into that actually very curious. And one of the things that I learned was that if I evaluated somebody else's opinions based on my values and experience, that was the wrong metric. And I really had to understand their values, their experiences, their social context, in order to see that their opinions made complete sense in that context. And so then changing their opinion wasn't even the idea. That for me, humanizing that other person and truly understanding better where they were coming from was such a gift that I got from that.
That's powerful. It raises a question in my mind. How often, if ever, do you think differing views are actually stemming from the same fundamental value system? Do you think that's possible that people are really in disagreement on certain issues, let's say about immigration, when if you really drill down deeply enough, they share core values?
Yeah, I think that I love this question because I think that we have, you know, on an opinion level, some real differences, and on even a values level, we've got some differences. We also have some real core things that all humans are looking for. And I don't know, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy, that's a great place to see what some of these things are, where, you know, we all want safety and security. You know, we want a home. We want to feel like we're not in danger. We want to have enough food. We want to have enough resources for ourselves and the people we care about. We want to feel a sense of belonging with other people. We want to feel like we can connect with other people and have relationships. So there's all these things that, yeah, absolutely, we have those things in common. So if we look at, you know, at some different issues, we can see where we apply those differently in different situations. Like, I think actually guns and abortion are one of my favorite places to look at this issue, because, again, things that have huge controversy. So people who are pro-choice seem to be also more likely advocating for gun control. And people who are pro-life are, you know, more often advocating for gun rights, you know. And so we think, okay, well, these people are very, very different people. But then when I sort of dig down and I was thinking about this, I thought, okay, well, people who are pro-choice, they want freedom of choice about their bodies and about reproductive rights. Well, people who want gun rights, they want freedom of choice. They want to be able to make those choices themselves about whether they own a gun and what kind of guns and how they use that. And both sides are saying, trust me, I can make these decisions myself. And then on the flip side, both sides are saying, but no, like, this is dangerous to other people, what people might do. And, you know, so the gun control folks are saying, well, but look at all these people who are dying from gun use. And so we need to restrict the gun use. And the people who are pro-life are saying, look at all these, you know, the unborn children who are dying because of abortion. And so you can't just make your own choices there, because there are people who are in danger, and especially children. And when I looked at these arguments, I thought, wow, the structures of these arguments are so similar, just applied to different issues. And I thought, well, in some ways you could look at that as being, we are in completely different places. And on another level, you could look at that and say, wow, we are all completely the same.
I definitely still want to get into the specific tools of dialogue, but just on another more abstract level, while we're on this topic, what is the way forward in terms of, let's say, like, policies, when that's the recognition? What you just described, I love that. I feel like I've kind of had a similar experience, you know, of recognizing that we're kind of coming from the same place, even though we ended up in different places politically. So what's the way forward on policy levels and just on living in harmony as a society?
Such a good question, because really that's, you know, those are the agreements that we make as a society about how to live together. So one of the things that we're doing is we're making it very difficult for our elected officials to even have those conversations with each other. The more polarized we are as an electorate, the harder it is for us to give our elected officials any wiggle room in terms of having those conversations, in terms of, you know, some of it's about policy and some of it's about public statements, you know, and how, and the positioning and all of that. And we're, I feel like we're asking our elected officials to, you know, to take those positions that are consistent with the more extreme, which is, you know, who's speaking out and who's doing the most advocacy and all of that. And again, most people aren't extremists. So it's not actually satisfying the needs of most people. It's frankly not even satisfying the needs of people at the extremes. And as a society, it's just, you know, like policymaking has ground to a halt in so many ways because of this. So, you know, people say, oh, the elected officials need to do this. They need to have these conversations with each other. And I feel like, again, most of us are not elected officials. What can we do? And so if we can, like, if we can't have these conversations with each other, how do we expect people in the public eye to actually have these conversations with each other? So I think we need to start as, you know, in families, in communities, with people on the plane next to us, humanizing ourselves and each other. The more we allow other people to see who we are, and the more we are curious about and learning more about who they are, I think the better chance we have of allowing our elected officials to make policy that meets the needs of our community as a whole.
It's a great answer. And perhaps it's optimistic to say that the elected tend to reflect the electorate, because the electorate votes them in. And so if there's a transformation to the electorate, to the voters, to the people, that would be reflected in who is elected and the elected officials. And therefore, as sophisticated as the conversation is between people, that sophisticated conversation will translate to the political stage. I am hopeful. And your hope inspires me. You know, you say several times in the book that your professional experience and research are inspire hope in you. And that inspires me. And it's nice to hear that from someone who's watching this psychology so closely.
I've become even more optimistic since I wrote the book, because since I wrote the book, I've gotten even more connected in with the networks of other people who are doing this work. And there are individuals, organizations that are doing this work to bridge the divide, to bring people together. Things like Braver Angels and Living Room Conversations. And they're really giving people opportunities to have these conversations and apply some of these tools. And there are so many people involved in these organizations. And that's just been fantastic, just on, you know, to be connected with all these folks on Twitter and to have my Twitter feed filled up, not with people who are like, you know, on the extremes and just so angry and upset at the other side, but people who are really moving this forward in terms of creating these connections. It just makes me feel so good every day to see that, and gives me hope. And I think then the hope is founded on something too, you know, on all of these people who have invested in this.
I'll just reference a YouTube channel called Middle Ground as well. That's another one that inspires hope in me. And it just gets people who have opposing views, and they have dialogue, at least discourse. And I think sometimes it turns into dialogue with a real human connection and intent to understand. Let's talk about how we can engage in dialogue. And perhaps, you know, I was planning on about an hour, so perhaps we can engage for another 20, 25 minutes. And I partly say that for the listeners as well, so that you would know how much you're in for if you keep listening here. But both from the perspective of listening and speaking, Let's talk about the skills of dialogue. And I have to say up front, I felt like you called me out in your book. There is something that I consider myself a good listener. I am a good listener. And there was something you wrote about, what did you describe it? Minimal encouragers. You wrote about how to listen attentively, and minimal encouragers is one of those. Mm-hmm. I have not gotten very good at that. And it's been funny to watch myself back in these podcasts. You even talk about the bobblehead, imitating a bobblehead. I do that so much. And sometimes I almost feel like I'm just feeling what the person is saying. I'm almost dancing to it in a sense. But I also think that just silent presence and a still presence, even on a body language level, is extremely powerful. So I really took that one to heart. I think my encouragement helps when I'm listening, but I do it a little much.
Well, I have felt very listened to in this conversation. So I think you're doing great at whatever level you're doing it right now. And I think, you know, some of these things, you know, we can always get better at them, you know. So I think that's fine. But it does seem like just the fact that you knew, like, okay, I'm gonna nod my head, gonna give people time to speak, that's probably more important than being too hard on ourselves about, did I nod my head too much? You know, did I, you know, so we have to be a little bit forgiving of ourselves and each other, because we're all just human. And this is all just, you know, one of the things that I realized about going into these conversations is that people want to craft a message so that they're like, what exactly should I say? What should I be drawing on? And they're really focused on that. And crafting a message is much less important than being fully present. And the thing I realize that people want about crafting a message is that then you know what's going to happen. You know that you're going to say this thing, and it's kind of scripted, and that's easier. That's less vulnerable. Right. But we are just going into this, you know, not knowing what's going to happen. Like our conversations are improv, you know, and they should be. Mm-hmm. And they should be really kind of in that alive and you don't know where things are going to go place. And that is scarier, but that is the most important thing we can do, I think, for human connection, is just to be present and allow ourselves to be vulnerable in that way.
It's beautiful. And that perhaps is what's at the heart of the healing potential of dialogue that you talk about. Yes, yes. All right. So talk to me more about what practical things can people do to listen.
Okay. So listening, probably the most important things are, first of all, go into it with curiosity. You've got to go in actually wanting to know about the other person. And so then if you really want to know about the other person, when they speak, instead of, you know, well, they'll say their opinion, instead of saying your opinion back, which is, you know, maybe thought about as listening to respond. Like the whole time they're talking, I'm going to think about what I'm going to say back to them, you know, about making my point and they're wrong and I'm going to show them that. That's how we often think about the conversations and how we often perform in them. But if we're really listening to try to understand and we hear someone else's opinion, what we can do is reflective listening. We can reflect back to them what we just heard. So rather than saying our opinion, we basically say their opinion right back to them. We say what we heard them say, oh, so you're saying this, or, oh, it sounds like this. And you know, it's what we learn as therapists also. We learn to do this. And it does a couple of things. First of all, it makes sure that you did actually understand what they were saying. So they've said something and you say, oh, it sounds like this. And they're like, well, no, that's not exactly it. And either because we didn't get it right, or because for them just hearing it back makes them sort of pause and think, oh, no, I could say it a little bit differently, you know. And the other thing that it does is it helps them to feel understood. And that's helping to create that connection, that relationship that we need to reach whatever kinds of dialogue goals we have. So listening, giving people uninterrupted time to speak, reflecting back. And then when we ask questions, asking questions that encourage elaboration. Oh, you know, I'd be interested in hearing more about this. Oh, can you tell me about how you develop those ideas? Or were there people you encountered in your life who really influenced you on that? Those are questions that encourage somebody to elaborate on what they've been saying. Often what we'll want to do instead is ask these kind of gotcha questions of like, oh, but if you think that, then shouldn't this? Or, you know, don't you think this? And those aren't actually helpful for dialogue. They're not going to get you where you want to go. And so asking questions that encourage elaboration.
You know, my wife's a great listener, and I've learned a lot from how she listens. And I remember one time we were having a difficult conversation and I expressed myself thoroughly. And at the end of it, there was just this long moment of pause where it certainly felt like she was processing what I was saying. And then she just asked, what else? And I said, more. And just that simple question was very powerful and it just, like you said, it made me feel understood. It made me feel as though I was being paid attention to, and as though she really wanted to understand me completely and give me the complete opportunity to fully express myself. So yeah, that was powerful. And
like, I love that.
Right. Mm. Encouraging elaboration like that. And you talk about how when you're reflecting back to someone, what you understood that they just said, to do so in few words, kind of, as you say, nuggetize it, make it just a short snippet.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And also using few words and asking for elaboration, like kudos to your wife. Like, that is such a perfect way of encouraging elaboration without, often when we ask long questions or when we reflect in lengthy ways, we derail someone from their thinking. They've now got to pay attention to our reflection or our question instead of staying in kind of sharing, which is what we want them to do. And so, yeah, what else? Perfect. That is perfect.
Before we transition to talk about how to speak in dialogue, what guidance would you offer people? I think it's a common experience where even I'm kind of honestly thinking outside of politically oriented conversations, just dialogue in general, when someone has fully expressed themselves and you just don't know what to say. You simply you've understood them. You don't have any questions. You don't have any sage wisdom to offer. You just don't know what to say. I do feel like people get anxiety about that because they feel like they should say something. Mm-hmm. So what would you say to help people?
That's a great problem that people, thank you for bringing that in, because it's a very real situation. People are like, oh, what do I do with silence?
Right.
And so one of the things we can do is just get a little bit more comfortable with silence. What might feel like forever silence is not that long. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing, is don't feel like you have to jump in right away with everything. Now, there's also very different styles of communication. There's, communication is different in different cultures and things. So that kind of overlapping conversation is more common in some cultures. It might feel more uncomfortable to some people than others. Mm. So if you're somebody who's feeling uncomfortable with it, I think breathe a little bit, focus on your breathing, just sort of be there with it. And sometimes people will then continue on and say more when they know that there's space for them to do so. And, give things some space to give people some space to move into, and then the other thing you can do is if it feels like they're complete, I often thank them. It's like, thank you so much for sharing that. That's always a thing that you can do.
Okay. So I think some of that anticipatory anxiety that, again, you talk about, I think that's really paralyzing for people. I think it's quite difficult to approach difficult conversations. And so perhaps having some tools for how to express yourself in dialogue could soothe that anxiety a bit. So can you talk to us about that? What tools do we have for speaking in dialogue?
Sure, because people always, I spend in my workshops, spend half the time on listening, and people are like, when do I get to talk? So the important thing, like, first, yes, you will get to talk, but when you get to speak, how do you speak about your own perspectives that might actually, again, help you to achieve your goals? So one thing that can be really helpful is think about sharing as sharing your story rather than sharing your opinions. And so the same kinds of things you might be asking people to elaborate on, you can share. It's like, not just about here's this opinion that I have and here's this research that backs it up, but here's how I came to this opinion. Here's what my values are that inform this, and here's how those values seem connected to this issue for me. Here are these people who I've encountered who have really influenced me. Here's an experience that I had that shifted things for me. So all of that can, first of all, be easier for someone to hear when they disagree with you, like rather than you sharing just your opinion. And frankly, I think it makes for a much more interesting conversation than just people sharing hot takes back and forth. And so I even think it's useful to have these conversations with people who agree with you on things. Because often we end up in these conversations with people who agree with us, of everyone just going, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm like, okay, I want a more interesting conversation than that. So, and it also helps us to recognize sometimes that there's nuance there and that we might have some differences even with people who we agree with. And I think that's valuable also, to just loosen things up a little bit.
I like that a lot. And I had an interesting conversation a couple podcast episodes ago with a social psychologist named Corey Clark, who identifies herself as a political psychologist and really focuses on the psychology around political dynamics and discourse. And she was describing the way that when you identify with a certain group, there is this natural tendency for conformity to occur within that group, because so much of that conformity is being reinforced by acceptance within the group. And so there's this just, again, natural tendency to kind of drift into extremes to some degree. And so what you just described, of in a way almost looking for the nuanced ways in which you disagree with the people that you generally agree with, I think promotes heterogeneity within in-groups. And I think that's very healthy. I think it becomes just a more thoughtful group of people when that's the case.
Yeah, yeah. It also gives people a chance to talk about, to share their story. Yeah. In a low stakes situation. Mm-hmm. And that's something that can be helpful, because if the only time that we're having that depth of conversation is with people who disagree with us, that's a lot harder to do. So it helps us to practice.
Mm. The other thing I'll share as we're talking about speaking in dialogue, I think it's true to say that many people realize what they really think only once they begin expressing themselves. And, you know, like you even mentioned this, that when listening, when you ask questions and you ask for elaboration or you reflect back, it gives the person a chance to rethink what they meant and how they want to express what they meant. And so I wish I could remember the poet exactly who said this or exactly what she said, but it was something like, I only know what I really think once I start writing poems. And I think there's the spirit of that is true in political conversations as well. I know it's true of myself that through dialogue, I've really gotten clarity on what I really think about certain things and why I think it. And that's very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It sometimes we need sounding boards. Yeah. And, you know, we can be that for each other.
Yes. And people to point out, just ask questions I might not have asked myself in a way. So let me ask you this question. I'm really curious what you've seen, what you believe, how optimistic you are that people can change their mind. Do people change their minds about these issues?
You know, it's interesting because I find myself in in this activity of trying to get people to change their minds about other people. And that's where I'm trying to get people to change their minds. And boy, is that hard, because I can lay out all of the research about how people have these distorted views. And that doesn't, you know, necessarily do it, the same way that laying out the research about, you know, whatever the political perspective is doesn't change people's minds. Mm-hmm. But there are some techniques that I think are helpful, and perspective taking is one of them. So I'll just share really briefly here. So I recently got a shingles vaccine. Mm-hmm. And because one of my Facebook friends posted, "Oh my gosh, I have shingles. It's really painful. Everyone who's over 50, go get your shingles vaccine." I was like, wow, I've been eligible to get this vaccine for the past 5 years, and I just hadn't gotten around to it. And I thought, oh wow, with the COVID vaccine, people are, you know, talking about, well, why aren't people getting this vaccine? And, you know, all this stuff, how can people say they're just not getting around to it? And I was like, oh wow, this is an interesting perspective taking activity for me to think about all the reasons that I didn't get the shingles vaccine. I'm not like an anti-vaxxer. I'm not, you know, like there aren't political reasons or identity group reasons for me not to get it. I hadn't gotten it, and it sort of slipped my mind and all these things. And I thought, wow, what if we all think about, and I posted this on my Facebook because I was like, hey, are there any preventative health things that you need to do? Like, are you due for a pap smear or a colonoscopy or an eye exam? And like, here's a gentle reminder to do that thing. And also maybe think about why you haven't done it. And that might help to inform your understanding of people who haven't gotten a vaccine for COVID. I mean, so some of that's about politics, and some of it's about, you know, misinformation or information, but not all of it is, because we're all doing these things. So I think whenever we can sort of get ourselves in a situation where we've experienced a little bit of what somebody else has, and to draw on that to understand them and humanize them rather than distancing them and being so upset with them, I think we're a step closer.
Hmm. Amen. I know we're about at the end of our conversation, but I'll just add that I also thought it was very valuable that you had a whole chapter on managing emotions. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, as you know, and just saying it for the listeners, this term emotional hijacking, when we get hijacked by emotions and kind of lose our ability to act and speak rationally. And we often regret the things we do when we are overcome with fear-oriented or anger-oriented emotions. So I just want to kind of just sprinkle that into the end of the conversation here, that I agree that that's extremely valuable to have present moment internal regulation strategies for managing emotions, because so many of these issues are personal for us and may even relate to our own personal rights. And so it's very triggering when someone questions whether you should have those rights, or questions whether your identity is valid, or what privileges you should have, etc. And it's not to say that, like, I think that emotions are important in these conversations. It's good to feel what you're feeling. There have been many times in our history where anger has been totally appropriate in situations of injustice, but the capacity to channel that anger directed appropriately is a very important skill, and one that I think takes a long time to develop. So I just said a lot, I know, but any last thoughts on that, on the importance of managing your emotions?
I'm so glad that you brought some attention to that, because I do think it's really important, because people are having those emotions not only in conversation, but in anticipation of those conversations. Mm-hmm. And it's keeping us from actually even starting the conversation. So I think we can practice some of those things even just as we're imagining talking to people and listening to people. And probably the last skill I just want to leave people with is breathing. We're all breathing all the time, but there are ways of breathing that can help us to stay calm or to regain our equilibrium when we start to, you know, feel flushed and our heart's racing and our muscles get tense. And so I always think of it as breathing as if you're blowing bubbles, and to bring us back to bubbles just in the end here. So taking a deep breath and letting it out slowly, gently, that's the kind of breathing that will help us to actually move beyond our bubble.
Beautiful. Well, I wonder what the future has in store for our relationship, Tanya, but I certainly hope our paths cross again. This has been a very enjoyable conversation. And like I said in the very beginning, the more people who read this book, the better. The more people who listen to you speak in this interview, the better. So thanks to everyone who's listening and watching. Share it with a friend if you think that it would help them. And Dr. Tanya Israel, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.